Good morning, everybody. Welcome to day two of Debian Miniconf 6.1. You'll notice that due to my absence yesterday, this event got NMU'd, hence the version number. But it's a native package we decided, so the numbering is a bit odd anyway. This morning we're going to do something quite different. The very first session we're going to run through a quick introduction to a number of distributions. The general point of this is to look outside Debian and get some idea of what other people are doing. Obviously, there are a lot of distributions with different focuses, and they go about things in a very different way. And a lot of the time, we end up inward looking, and it's useful sometimes to see totally different approaches to problems and the way things are being done. So over the first 40 minutes or so, what we'll do is have about 5 or 6 minutes from a representative from each of these projects just to explain to us what their project is about, what distinctive features it might have, but this is not a time for throwing rotten tomatoes and things like that. This is just a time to get an introduction and overview to all of these projects. And then we're going to have a discussion during the second session from topics that might come out of some of the things that have been raised in the first session. So first up, most of us in the room are very well familiar with Debian, but for the benefit of those from other distros that are here, AJ is going to give us a 5-minute intro to what Debian is about. So, 5 minutes. Do you need 5 hours? So, thanks, AJ.
How many people here aren't at all familiar with Debian? Yeah, don't lie about it, Vidal. And who isn't already a Debian developer? And aren't familiar with Debian? It was too combined, because all the people who were sticking their hands up not knowing Debian were Debian developers. Okay, we've got one person. And how many people kind of don't know how Debian works? They've just seen it for download and stuff. And who isn't a past DPL? Crying out loud. I'm sure he's a past perfect DPL or something too. And who wants to run for the next DPL? Yeah, where is Matthew Garrett? Oh, he's still not here, isn't he? Okay, so Debian's a volunteer project. It's committed to free software. Way back in 97 or so, we came up with the Debian Free Software Guidelines, which at the time were one of the first clear statements of what free software actually means. Shortly after that, the Free Software Foundation came up with their list of the four freedoms, the freedom to use, freedom to distribute, the freedom to modify, the freedom to something else. Yeah, it's a great one. And so Debian's been kind of one of the forerunners of actually helping free software and getting it to be actually well understood and well known. So the Debian Free Software Guidelines formed the basis of the open source definition way back when Netscape was launching their browser and wanted a nicer name than free software. And so Debian's a volunteer project, and so while I'm the Debian project leader, that doesn't actually mean anything much more than if someone asks who's the leader, then they can point to me and we can go off and not really do anything useful. So if you want anything to get done in Debian, you don't have to really worry about the leader. You can just go and do it or talk to other people who want to work with you on it and do it. The special powers of the leader are virtually zero. You have some money that you can kind of suggest people might want to use, but that doesn't really happen. You can launch a general resolution on your own instead of needing 5 people to agree with you, and that's really about it. So, no, just the top of your shirt. Thank you. Yes, laptops are wonderful things. So one of the things that means is there's no overriding direction for Debian. So the people who contribute to whatever they want to do. So if there are a few people who want to release on time, then some effort goes into that. If there are a few people who don't really care about releasing on time and just want to work on their packages, effort goes into that. If there's conflicts, people have to work that out together, and there's no one person who can say, well, you're not going to be involved in Debian anymore, your concerns don't count, this is the way we're going to do it. So unlike Fedora and Red Hat, there's no possibility of an ultimate resolution. So if you've got Ubuntu, then Mark Shuttleworth can say, this is the way we're going to do it. We're going to have this particular arrangement for Windows in this version, and that's the way it is. Maybe in a later version we'll change that, maybe not. In Debian, there's no one person who can say that. The maintainers of packages get to decide how their packages work, and that's it. That's a different person for just about every package. So Debian's really large because it's got 1,000-odd volunteers and more who contribute to it. It has lots of different goals, so lots of different architectures, lots of different packages, and they're all kind of basically treated equal and supported to essentially the same level. So that too was an introduction.
Okay, next up we have Bernard Gray talking about CIDEX.
Hello. This is something very different for me. I'll give myself a quick introduction. I'm presenting on a distribution called CIDEX, or CIDUX, or CIDUX, however you like to pronounce it and wherever you come from. I develop, or I volunteer my time doing a little bit of development for them, and I work full-time at the Bodley Wines, where we have a fairly strong open source view. I'll get into it. Jonathan gave me three questions. What is CIDEX? How is CIDEX related to Debian? And why is CIDEX cool? These are all very personal questions to all the users. For a lot of my content, I just went out and asked users about what their views were on these questions and attempted to compile that as best I could. What is CIDEX? It's a Linux distribution for x86 and x86-64 processors. It was formed on the 24th of November 2006. That makes it less than 2 months old. The interesting thing behind it is that it has several years of history behind it. Many of you might be aware of a distribution called Canonix. It was essentially a fork of Nopix, and anyway, it had a dictator called Kano who had decided that he was going to change Canonix's direction. Wanted to base it on a more stable base. I'm not sure if he's made the decision yet, but the options were Debian Etch or Ubuntu. Unfortunately, an awful lot of Canonix users and developers wanted a SID-based distribution, and they wanted Canonix to remain that way. There was no real option. CIDEX was formed by a lot of the Canonix users and developers to fill that gap. It's based on Debian Unstable, as I just said, SID. Distributed on a live CD, and it's hard disk installable. The whole project is community driven. There's no corporate backing, there's no payment. It's supported by donations, and it's supported by the enthusiasm of the users and developers. And it's aimed primarily at the desktop. It supports current hardware. The software is bleeding edge, the kernels are bleeding edge. For desktop users, this is important. The desktop hardware tends to change the most rapidly. They need that current support. So it's a nice thing for the hardware upgrade junkies. How is CIDEX related to Debian? CIDEX is Debian. We use the official Debian unstable repositories. We're not a fork, such as, for example, Ubuntu, which I believe, fork the Debian code base and supply their own repositories and code. CIDIX has similar philosophies to Debian with regards to the social contract and the definition of free software, which Anthony touched on earlier. CIDIX contributes back to Debian by having, well, essentially a willing supply of cannon fodder. People who want to take the unstable code and use it. We provide early testing, bug reporting, bug fixes, and a few of the developers have done a lot of work Debianizing various packages. Two that I believe are worth mentioning are the FreeNX packages and the WPA supplicant package. The enthusiasm of the CIDIX community draws enthusiasm to the Debian project. We have a very friendly view of Debian. We like it, we like what it does, and that's, well, we have a good relationship with them. CIDIX users are also Debian users. Obviously, CIDIX isn't for everyone or every application, and in the case where a CIDIX isn't a suitable OS candidate, a CIDIX user is more likely to choose testing or stable Debian to install. So it draws users to Debian. Why is CIDIX cool? And this is my personal question of them all. CIDIX focuses on providing the help and support required to run a SID-based distribution. I've never used pure SID on its own. I've never used pure Debian until relatively recently. So I had to do a bit of research, and this is not by personal experience, just from general comments that I've found around the place. So my comment before, unstable can be considered the front line for packages entering Debian. According to various sources, including the SID FAQ that I found on Woolwich.org, Debian provides a no-care, no-responsibility approach to helping SID users. I quote from that article, "Don't cry if it breaks." What CIDIX does is it takes an all-care, no-responsibility approach instead. All help that can be provided is. Unresolvable and critical issues are flagged on the site in a timely manner, and the users and developers are easy to contact via IRC and the forums. We have a largely international base. We have developers from Germany, Ireland, Netherlands, a few from Australia, New Zealand, and England. And you'll find that there is a developer of some kind online 24 hours a day. In the short time that I've been involved with CIDIX and previously Canonix, I've seen that this approach breeds an excellent support base of users. Beginners with major issues aren't turned away. People will work for days to either fix or resolve issues as far as they can, or exhaust all paths getting there. This generates goodwill in those users. They come back and they put the work in themselves and regenerate that cycle. Some of the users that I'd like to mention specifically is a guy called Bluewater. He's Trevor Walkley. He's an Australian guy. No specific coding skills or anything like that, but he's managed to generate, in the month and a half we've been together, a 70-page manual, plus arranging the translation into 4 other languages, with more to come. And that's a fairly big achievement, I think, in the time given. Harold Hope, H2, has compiled a script managing kernel upgrades, dist upgrades, driver upgrades, and covers all known issues as well as providing warnings via this script. You basically run it, it upgrades your system, and it's away you go. There's usually no issues related to it. He continually works on testing whether the dist upgrades are still safe from earlier versions of Canonix, and manages to probably something like seven or eight dist upgrades per week on various different system states. And also Devil, I don't know his real name, forum and IRC support, he's always there, he's always helping, and he always knows where to go when you're stuck. CIDIX brings bleeding-edge software and hardware support to a class of users who would never be able to run it otherwise. CIDIX isn't unfriendly for newbies. It's very easy to install, it's very easy to run, and it's very easy to upgrade and maintain. CIDIX also supports, CIDIX is open everything, code development and tools. I'll mention in particular the full story repository on Berlioz.de. That's where all the CIDIX code is maintained. We use one tool in particular is the FLL Builder. That's the tool we use for building CIDIX Live CD. It's based on the Live package from Debian, which is Holger covered yesterday. If you want to try out CIDIX, go to the repository, grab the code, build the CD. And that's about it. We're out of time. No worries. Thanks for your time.
Okay, next up, representing OpenSUSE, we have Crispin Cohen. Andreas, you're today, but Crispin is going to be speaking.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Crispin, this is Andreas. I'm the security architect for SUSE Linux, so I'm pretty focused on security issues.
Andreas Girardi, I'm the founder of probably the most successful one developer distro ever existed, which is Yopa, and I work for Novell in the pre-sales team. Obviously with Yopa, I've proven that I'm good at hyping something not worth hypeable up to a point where a lot of people download it. So I think sales is quite okay to me, and I'm happy for a few tomatoes flying today, so if you brought them, I'm the man to hit, okay?
So, OpenSUSE versus Debian. Well, this is silly as the Debian crowd. Debian is about freedom. OpenSUSE is a free distro, but I'm not going to stand here and claim that we're as free as Debian is. So if you want a commercial enterprise type distro, you know where to find us. Instead, I want to talk to you about a SUSE feature called AppArmor for Debian. This is AppArmor. What it addresses is the problem that your applications aren't perfect. They've always got this chronic stream of bugs, and when attackers figure out how to exploit the bugs, they first take over your program and then they take over your computer. And what AppArmor does is securely confine the application so that it only accesses the resources that it needs. So when the attacker comes along and exploits your application, he finds himself in a teeny-weeny jail that doesn't get to do anything interesting. Zooming in a little, this is an AppArmor profile. The example is NTPD, the Network Time Protocol Daemon, and it needs two interesting things. One is it needs to be root privileged because it's going to mess with your system time, and two is that it needs an open network port so that it can talk to the time server, and this is an ugly combination that sysadmin's guides tell you not to do. This AppArmor profile here says, well, yes, even though it's running as root, it only gets access to these five POSIX capabilities and these files, never mind that it's root. The files are absolute path names with embedded shell syntax wildcards. There's the AppArmor architecture diagram, which substantially is Linux 2.6 plus the LSM interface that lets AppArmor be in the kernel but not of the kernel. It's a module you can plug it in, and then there's software on top of it so that you can wrap profiles around each of your applications. And in the commercial world, you have Novell Yast, and it's nice, but you don't need that. It has all command line driven tools, so it should be portable to any distro. This is the procedure for how you build a profile. Basically, you put the policy into learning mode and run it, and AppArmor learns what your application does and builds a policy for you. Nice properties of the language, nothing new about it. It's an overlay on top of existing Unix semantics. You have to pass all of the usual chmod user group world permissions first, and then AppArmor will consider whether you get to access that file. The syntax is nothing new. Absolute path names using classic shell syntax wildcards. So star means what you think it means. Square bracket means what you think it means. Squiggly bracket means what you think it means. The only even slightly new thing is that a single star matches things between a slash, and a double star will match the slashes as well. So double star .html means give me all the .html files in this entire directory tree. Similarly, the modes on the end are things like R, W, and X, so that shouldn't be too strange to you either. If you know how to use Bash, Chmod, and Grep, you're 80% trained on AppArmor. So AppArmor for Debian. No, I don't want to replace SE Linux. I want AppArmor to be a peer to SE Linux so that users can have a choice, just as they have a choice between GNOME and KDE. I'm looking for a Debian community member who finds AppArmor to be interesting and useful to be the Debian maintainer for this package. It has already been ported to Ubuntu by Magnus Runesen. There's the URL. And similarly has been ported to Gentoo by Matthew Snellum. So a Debian port shouldn't be too difficult. And for more on AppArmor, come see my talk Friday afternoon in Matthew's Hall B. Thank you.
Thanks. All right, Richard. Is Richard here? Yes. Richard is here. Fantastic. So from Red Hat, Richard Keech.
Thank you, Jonathan. I feel somewhat a bit like Daniel in the Lion's Den. A little bit of background. I was asked at fairly short notice to participate, which I'm very happy to do, and at even shorter notice told that I was presenting. Like, this is 5 minutes before coming in here today. So I'll start by adding a word to maybe to some of your vocabulary, extemporaneous. It's what I'm about to do, talking off the top of my head about the differences between Red Hat / Fedora on the one hand and Debian on the other. We've got Chris Blizzard here, so he's going to help me in discussing aspects of Fedora. Yeah, so perhaps with Jonathan's kind permission, I'll speak for a couple of minutes about Red Hat and a little bit of background about how we sit Red Hat in general, and Chris can talk about Fedora in particular. So just to show this isn't completely extemporaneous, I do have a couple of scribbled notes. I just wanted to start with an anecdote. About 5 years ago, could be more, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, I attended a Linux Installfest in Melbourne, and a reasonably well-known member of the Linux community, who I didn't know at the time, saw that I worked for Red Hat and approached me and said, "Hi, I work for the enemy." And I said, "Oh, you work for Microsoft, do you?" And he said, "No, I do Debian." To which my response was, "You are not the enemy." So I just wanted to make that clear from the start. I and certainly most of the people I deal with in Red Hat do not in any way consider Debian the enemy. We're all on the same team. Perhaps I should just give a very, very quick background to Red Hat, where we came from, and then talk about my opinions on some of the key fundamental differences between Red Hat and Debian. Red Hat came about back in 93, 94, so it's quite a long way ago, when a fellow named Mark Ewing, who I believe worked for IBM at the time, was a fan of Slackware. And he didn't like the way it was packaged. He didn't like the way that you couldn't upgrade packages easily, you couldn't install, you all know the story. Mark came up with a set of Perl scripts called the Red Hat Packaging Program, which over time evolved into what we now know today as the Red Hat, as RPM, the Red Hat Packaging Method. And that was the key initial innovation upon which Red Hat was based, a distribution that was much easier to install and upgrade than what was available at the time. Since then, Debian's come along, done its own thing in the way of packaging, and that superficially is the key structural fundamental difference between Red Hat on the one hand and Debian on the other hand is the way we package software. But it meets the same goals using a different implementation, in my opinion. So I'm not going to compare and contrast the Debian packaging approach with RPM. I don't think that would be a useful thing to do. I think they both achieve approximately the same thing in slightly different ways. Probably the other most fundamental difference between Debian and Red Hat is where we have a commercial audience for the most part, and we have predictable release cycles. So I'm not a user of Debian, but from what I see, you know, as one of the main criticisms leveled at Debian is the release cycle and the unpredictable nature of it. Predictably unpredictable. So Red Hat ships pretty well like clockwork, and that's good for a lot of people. But at the end of the day, we're all on the same team. We all contribute back. Perhaps I can round this out by talking about what I've seen as a few myths about Red Hat, myths that perhaps represent some misunderstandings about Red Hat. Perhaps some of these myths are misunderstandings held perhaps by people here. One thing I sometimes hear is that Red Hat has proprietary stuff in it. This is not true. Red Hat is completely, thoroughly an open source distribution. Red Hat ships a box set which has an extras CD. This extras CD does have some things which are not open source licensed, but they are not considered part of the distribution. They are things that we have entered into agreements with some other people. They are things like Acrobat Reader. We've entered into an agreement with Agfa for some extra fonts. Things like that. I don't think that changes, that in no way, in my opinion, makes Red Hat a proprietary distribution. Those things are not part of the distro. They're outside it. So Linux, Red Hat doesn't have proprietary stuff in it. I hear from some people, or get the impression from things I read, that people think Red Hat takes from the community but doesn't give. I think Chris will address this better than me, but in my opinion, we are committed to not forking. Fork is the last resort. We commit back to the upstream as an absolute first preference. And we are an extremely vigorous contributor to much of the core infrastructure that all distros depend upon. So I think we carry our weight in that regard. So they're the main sort of things that I hear some people say or suggest. There are other ways in which we differ from Debian, things like our automated installer called Kickstart is pretty cool. It works and is a great way of installing machines quickly. We've got Exec Shield, SE Linux installed by default. These are things that I'm not going to get into any detail. And John, do I have time to hand over to Chris for a few minutes? So with that as a bit of a very quick background to Red Hat, I'll hand over to Chris to talk about Fedora.
Hi, how's it going? Great. So has anybody here actually installed FC5 or FC6? All right. That's good. Some free software lovers. That's what I like to hear. I worry, like, having a distro summit, it's like you end up with these strange versus things. I was talking to Greg de Konigsberg, who is sort of one of the heart and soul, I think, of what Fedora is inside of Red Hat the other day, maybe a couple weeks ago. And I came to the realization that it's interesting, I'm not just paying lip service to this, that Debian is probably the only other project which cares about free software in the same way that Red Hat does as a company, and sort of embodied in Fedora, right? If you look at the history of Red Hat Linux, if you look at the history of Fedora as it's come to fruition over time, we're moving closer and closer to what Debian really is, right? If you look at the success of Fedora Extras, where's the DPL? Where are you? Oh, right there. You said you have like 1,000 contributors now or so? Official developers? Yeah, I was actually looking at our list. We're probably up around 500 now. We're actually half the size of the archives of Debian at this point. And the model that we're actually moving to is we're finally opening up core with Fedora 7. So that means that instead of having this stuff that only Red Hat people can change, we're finally opening it up for anybody to change. Although, you know, at the beginning it will be a lot of Red Hat owners. Yeah, finally in the year 2007, it's like pulling teeth. Like, yes, this is important. there's a lot of stuff to work on together. We're definitely moving to a more community model, community-driven model. We have, it's interesting to note that the number of people who have become contributors actually outnumbers Red Hat 4-1 now. So Red Hat only makes up a quarter of the contributor base. I would say that we still do a bulk of the engineering, especially in the packages we care about, from the kernel to GNOME, but most of that stuff ends up in upstream anyway, before it even gets into Fedora, right? So that's where most of our engineering work and ends up in Debian very often before it ends up in our code, which is sort of ironic, I think. not lost on us, I think. And really, I think our interest is sort of growing the number of users and developers no matter where they live, right? If you're using Debian, you're using Red Hat, it all wins, right? I guess that's an important point to make. We're interested in growing everything. I could say something ironic. I'd say I think we're the Debian that gets things done because we make releases on a regular basis. But I hope I'm not poking the bear too much by saying that in this room. And the other thing I will point out is that we're looking at really interesting ways to lower the barrier for our contributions. We've used package managers as they exist and source packages and patches for a long time. But we're trying to come up with interesting ways to make that really, really easy and make it possible to start sharing between distributions in a real way. I know Shuttleworth and Ubuntu have done some of that work, but it's my impression that it's fallen through the cracks and it's all proprietary stuff anyway. But we're interested in probably doing that in a very open way, right? I give you an example. We don't have a lot of... We use a mugshot as an example. Our server, like, it's open source, right? That's something that a lot of those people doing social networking sites do not do, is that we actually release the source code in the open. We allow people to hack it. We get contributions for it. It is an open source project. We're interested in doing the same thing with infrastructure as well, which is a pretty big difference, I think, than a lot of places that we've seen. So there's going to be a lot of that coming out of Red Hat, and there's a lot of opportunity to work together. And I'm not saying that because... it's the audience, I'm actually saying it because I think it's important for everybody to sort of try and make us as a movement more successful. So that's about it. If anybody wants to talk about it, I'm more than happy to afterwards. So is that good enough on time? Okay.
Okay, well, in terms of time, we're pretty much at the end of the first session. So what do you think? Should we have a break for a couple of minutes and we'll have the next couple of overviews after a 5-minute break, so see you back here in a moment.